Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Brown versus Jacobson Land and Cattle Company. It's Mr. Chamberlain.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Charles Chamberlain, an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Nebraska, here on behalf of the State of Nebraska, the appellant in this action. This is an adverse possession case. The standard of review in the adverse possession case is de novo on the record, and the court is obligated to reach determinations of both fact and law independent of the rulings of the lower court. In this specific case, two brothers from the Jessup family purchased adjoining parcels nearly 100 years ago and built a fence that deviated from the true property line based out of convenience due to topography, terrain, and difficulty. Mr. Brown...
What is there any direct testimony in the record about the intentions of the parties that actually built the fence?
There is testimony concerning the assumptions. The parties built the fence 100 years ago. The Jessup brothers are not around to testify directly themselves.
So it's circumstantial evidence.
It is, but it's strong circumstantial evidence. So Mr. Brown himself testified on the record that it's common in the area for fences to deviate from the true property boundaries because of the topography. You can also review in Exhibit 99 pictures from one end of the fence to the other and see the topography for yourself, as well as in Exhibit 100's a geological map, a topographical map from the U.S. Geological Service that will show you that the terrain and elevations change drastically. And there is testimony from multiple witnesses that it would be difficult to put the fence down the property line itself. If you look at Exhibit 23, it's a survey of where the fence sits in relation to the actual property boundaries. And you'll also see this isn't a slight deviation. This deviation encompasses 77 acres. So a large portion of an eighth of a section, approximately an eighth of a section of property. So there is strong evidence that the deviation is there because of the terrain, and there is no evidence to the contrary. No one stood up and asserted that there was a different reason for the fence being in its current location. And the law presumes that when individuals on opposite sides of the fence, when the fence are constructed, are related to one another, that fence and the use of the property is then permissive.
And there are three. How close does the relationship have to be?
Well, the Supreme Court has held where there are brothers and sisters, parent and child, grandparent and grandchild, or parent and step-parent, that was sufficient. Excuse me, stepchild and step-parent, that was sufficient family relationship for the presumption to attach. In this specific instance, we have descendants of the brothers who owned the adjoining parcel who testified they were brothers. Brothers is sufficient. So there's a presumption that attaches that the use of that property was originally by permission. Now, Mr. Brown sought out one of the family members.
So finish the sentence, please. Permission by whom, from whom to whom?
So
When the fence was originally erected,
Frank Jessup was the owner of title, and Stanley Jessup Sr. Was the brother who owned the adjoining parcel to the south. So Stanley Jessup Sr. is presumed to have permission from Frank Jessup to operate the property. And in the series of cases before this court previously in Pesch v. Widger, Barnes v. Milligan, and Chase v. Lavelle, we find that presumption continues on through related family members. So if you have a subsequent generation of family members that occupy both sides of the fence, that presumption continues as well.
So Frank is the owner of the portion of disputed property that's in Section 31.
At the time the fence was built.
At the time the fence was built.
And in Section 6.
And in the north half of the north half in 6, right?
Correct.
And he gives permission for Stanley Sr. to build a fence, or a fence is built.
That's correct.
And Stanley Sr., who has property south of the disputed property, gets to graze on the disputed portion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So then what rights does Stanley Sr. have when a lease gets made between Stanley Sr., or rather his son Stanley Jr. Bud, and Brown? What were the rights of the individuals to the lease? Who leased to whom, and what were their rights?
Sure. So the court has never put a limitation on the scope of the rights when there's presumed to be permission. So when you look at a family relationship, and without permission is presumed at this point to be plenary, and there's no evidence to the contrary in the record that there was a limitation or restriction on what could occur. Stanley Jessup Sr. eventually left the property to his son, Stanley Jessup Jr., who goes by Bud Jessup. So Bud Jessup. And Mr. Brown
Bud, and your theory is that Bud inherited or became entitled to that permission?
Correct. Family members were still on both right. sides of the fence. In fact, okay. the Jessup family owned title to the disputed property until 2014.
Okay.
So descendants of Frank Jessup contained ownership of title until 2014.
Okay, and then the lease that everyone is talking about, where Brown starts to lease, who's the lessor or lessors on the lease?
So the
which encompassed the disputed property.
That's
right?
correct.
Okay.
It would be Bud Jessup, or Bud Jessup, Stanley Jessup Jr. is his official right. name. He goes by Bud Jessup. And Mr. Brown sought out Bud Jessup and
there's two parties to the lease? So Bud and Brown?
As far as we are aware, there is no physical lease that was entered into evidence. This is testimony from Mr. Brown, and he speaks about it on the record, on the transcript, page 103, lines 4 through 14.
So it's an oral lease?
I believe so.
That occurs in the 80s?
That's correct, in the 1980s. Sometime after Mr. Brown seeks and obtains permission to lease the property, he continues to use the property in the exact same way that Bud Jessup used the property before him, grazing cattle.
So did the trial court say that Brown's leased it from the Jessups, plural? Was that incorrect, not supported by the evidence?
Well, I believe that what is supported by the evidence is that Bud Jessup had permission, and I believe the permission that he had from the owners of record, his family members, flowed through Bud Jessup to Mr. Brown. I think that's supported particularly by a case, Chase v. Lavelle. So in Chase v. Lavelle, there was an individual, a lady who owned property in western Nebraska. She had her father was using the property by her permission. He leased it to another family member, and the Supreme Court in that case found that the permission from the actual property owner flowed down through the lease to the individual who had been leasing under that presumed.
A non-family person.
It was a family person. It was a family member.
So that might be encompassed by presumption of permissiveness amongst family.
Well, in Chase v. Lavelle, the Supreme Court took two distinct lines of reasoning. They did discuss the fact that the lessee was also a family member, but they separately discussed that permission would flow down through the lease to a lessee. So I don't think that the conclusion in Chase v. Lavelle is dependent upon the fact that the lessee was related to the owner of record.
But let's fast forward to Brown purchases some property from Stanley Jr. Bud.
Correct. Okay. He purchases the adjoining parcel in 1992.
Okay.
The disputed property is not listed in that deed that's found in Exhibit 12. I know that the district court made a determination that Mr. Brown had purchased the disputed property. If you look at the deed, he just simply didn't. It's not listed there. He didn't purchase the disputed property.
But he used the property.
He continued to use it the exact same way he had
okay.
before when
and,
he leased it.
And what does that make him vis-a-vis that property?
I believe he's still operating under permission. In Chase v. Lavelle, the Nebraska Supreme Court said, when occupation of property begins by permission, it can never ripen to adverse possession unless the adverse intent is brought home to the true owner of record by actual notice. And there's
so
no
at this point, was
here.
Brown a tenant in suffrage?
Or a holdover tenant in essence. Yeah, his permission was still there. It hadn't been revoked. He was continuing to use it the exact same way he had before for decades.
So is the actual notice the issue regarding the public hearing, talking about the sale by, or the purchase by the state, is that where actual notice comes into play?
Those actions by Mr. Brown affect whether or not the owner of record had actual notice, yes. I think it's also direct evidence of his intent. You determine whether he had adverse intent based upon his actions. He's writing letters to landowners, trying to contacting the real estate agents, trying to purchase the property as late as 2013. He's showing up at public hearings, writing letters to the Nebraska Game Parks Commission, showing up at public meetings, and making statements where he at least implies that there's the ability of the record owner to buy and sell the property and of individuals to purchase the property. If there are no further questions, I would ask that you reverse the decision of the district court, find that the state has a title in the property, and cancel the defendants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Snyder, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Snyder. I'm from Scotts Bluff. I represent Terry Brown. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court and render judgment in favor of Mr. Brown for two reasons. First, the district court properly determined that Brown had obtained title of the disputed ground by adverse possession. And second, the district court properly rejected the state's affirmative defenses of latches, estoppel, and unclean hands. I think it sounds like there's interest in the question about permission, so I think I'm going to address that first. And the state relies pretty heavily on Chase versus Lavelle, 105 Nebraska 796. What happened in Chase versus Lavelle is a mother had some property in Nebraska, specifically a southwest section of a quarter. Her father owned the northwest section of the quarter. While the mother was here in Nebraska, they basically operated those two quarters together, her father and her. She eventually married and moved to San Francisco, at which time the father continued using the southwest quarter, the mother's quarter, or the daughter's quarter. Eventually, a son of the owner of the southwest quarter took over for the grandfather and began using the property. And he used it for 12 years, and the court actually said, had his use been as against a non-family member, it would have been sufficient to find adverse possession in favor of the son. However, the court expressly relied upon this rule, and they said, as between parties sustaining parental and filial relation, the possession of the land by possession of land of one by the other is presumed to be permissive and not adverse. To make such permission adverse, there must be some open assertion of hostile title other than mere possession and knowledge thereof be brought home to the owner of the land. This is the rule. Under it, the defendant's possession was never adverse.
Do you contend that that same rule does not apply in the context of a landlord-tenant relationship between unrelated parties?
I think the rule expressly applies to related parties and does not apply in this case. Here we have Mr.
Well, let me ask it a different way then. Do you, if permission is granted to a tenant, even though the tenancy stops, doesn't the permission continue until some action of the former tenant brings home to the owner that a claim is being asserted?
Well, if express permission is given by somebody, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a family member. But in this case, Mr. Brown rented or leased ground from Bud Jessup. Bud Jessup didn't have the authority or the power to lease the disputed ground. He didn't own it. But nonetheless, Mr. Brown used it, and those actions are sufficient, even as a lessee, to I think begin the process of adverse possession of the ground. And certainly after he purchased it in 1992, he still did not have permission from anyone, and he continued to use the ground in the manner that that ground was designed to use, primarily grazing cattle and hunting.
Are you contending, I just want to be clear about where you're coming from on this, that when members of the Jessup family owned both sides of the line, that the doctrine of permissive use did not apply, or you're not arguing about that?
No, I think it probably applied between the family members. I don't think there's any question about that. And Mr. Brown isn't a family member.
So does it follow then that Bud had permission from a family member?
Well, he had presumptive permission.
Okay.
That's what the, there's no evidence of anybody having specific permission to use the disputed ground.
Okay, if we were to conclude that Bud had permission from a family member and so forth, right? Then what happens when Bud forms a lease with Brown with respect to the disputed property?
Well, Brown's
inviting Brown to use it.
I don't know that there's any evidence that he invited Brown to use the disputed ground, and as I've said, I don't think Bud Jessup had the authority to lease that ground.
So Brown didn't say, I'm invited to use the disputed property, or it was part of the lease?
Brown didn't say that?
Yeah. What did Brown say about why he used the disputed property?
He used the disputed property because that's where the fence line was.
Did he understand it was part of the lease?
Well, he used it because that's where the fence line was, encompassing these 77 acres. But I don't think he ever had explicit permission, and he testified that he didn't have explicit permission from anybody to use that ground, and he certainly didn't after he purchased the property in 1992.
Is that the strongest part of your argument? It's where the fence is?
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
The location of the fence, is that the strongest part of your argument? Is that biggest part of your argument that
he gained adverse possession?
Right.
Yeah, the fence is certainly a part of it, plus Mr. Brown's use of the property.
Of what legal significance is it that Brown offered to buy the disputed property?
Yeah, I'd like to address that. Of course, the state claims he didn't have the intent because he attempted to purchase the property. There's a case directly on point called Oldig versus Fisk, 53 Nebraska 156. This is how the court framed the question in Oldig. The record then presents and succinctly presents the question of whether an attempt by one in the adverse possession of land to purchase from the true owner operates to divest his possession of its adverse character. The court went on to say, in buying what is outstanding, there is nothing partaking of the nature of an acknowledgement of the superiority of that title or an abandonment of one's former claim. The old title is not conveyed away or lost. Such an act admits only that the occupant deems it worthwhile to get rid of the outstanding title and unite it to the one under which he has been holding. It does not prove and does not even tend to prove a change in character of the possession or recognition of a title paramount. In purchasing of an outstanding title, there is nothing inconsistent with the former claim of ownership. It's generally conceded one may purchase an outstanding title to buy one's peace or prevent threatened litigation. And that was the holding from the Oldig case. So we would say the same thing applies here towards Mr. Brown's attempt to purchase the ground or his contact with Lashley Land and Cattle.
I know you're not going to agree with the premise, but I want you to, for purposes of my question, accept the premise that your client's use of the disputed land began as a permissive use.
Okay.
Is there anything in the record that would establish that he did something to bring home to the true owner, the record owner, if you will, the change in use or a change in status?
If you're asking if there was a change in what he did, no. I think the record is, and the evidence is that he continued to use the property in the same manner as when he leased it, as after when he bought it.
Okay. There's no indication that he told the record owner or communicated that I'm asserting ownership over this?
I don't think there's any evidence of communication between the owners of the north half or the south half of the property of Section 6 at any time, whether it was with Stan Bud Jessup or with my clients.
Who paid the taxes on the land, and does that have any significance?
there were various people that paid the taxes on the land, from James and Mary Jessup to John and Alan Jessup to the Jessup Trust.
But never Mr. Brown?
Never Mr. Brown.
Ever Mr. Bud Jessup or predecessor to...
There's no evidence of that. There is a case on point there as well, and that is Bush versus Griffin, 76 Nebraska 214. And what it says is not paying taxes is not to defeat the claim of adverse possession. And I think it is common sense that if that did defeat a claim on its own, I think it's a factor to consider, but if it defeated a claim on its own, we'd have virtually no successful adverse possession cases. The tax statements are sent to the record owner, and the ground is not separated from disputed ground in a tax statement. That's certainly the case here, because we had an odd-shaped 77-acre parcel in two different sections. And those, it would have been impossible to pay the taxes just on the disputed ground, as opposed to paying the entire tax on Section 6.
The Chief Justice asked if the fence was your strongest argument, but it's really two parts. The fence and the size of the disputed tract, aren't those the strongest arguments that you have?
Yes, I believe so.
Thank you.
How about the oil and gas lease? What impact does that have?
Well, there's no question that there was an oil and gas lease, but the mineral estate is a separate estate, and there's no evidence that there was actually any gas or oil exploration on this property.
So there's no evidence that anybody went out and did work on it, explored the property, sunk wells, or
no, there's not. Anything?
Was Mr. Brown aware of that oil and gas lease?
I don't believe so, no.
There's nothing in the record to that.
There's nothing in the record to that effect. Well, if there's nothing else, I thank you and ask you to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is In Re Estate of Helms.